It's wonderful to have you out here today, and as always, would encourage you to open up your Bibles and follow along as we study this morning. You see the lesson topic here is spending our lives. That comes from that verse 3 that David just read for us, how people spend your life, and you do. You'll spend your life in something. It may feel like we spend a lot of time at our work, or we might spend a lot of time raising the kids, or we spend a lot of time on who knows what. But on a spiritual basis, you'll spend your life on something. It'll either be goodness and purity and righteousness, or it'll be on the things that are talked about there in verse 3. Things like envy and strife and jealousy and all of that. So we'll spend our lives somewhere doing something. What will we spend it on? I want to suggest that we can dovetail this with something we talked about weeks and weeks ago, and that is waiting on the Lord. So spending our lives waiting on the Lord. Let's go to Titus chapter 3 again and consider there verse 3. I want to pick up on the language that he uses. And it says in verse 3, For we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures. And here's our phraseology, spending our life in malice, in envy, hateful, hating one another. What a way to spend a life, huh? Now that, you know, when we step back from that and say, you know, if I could spend just an extra 10 minutes tomorrow hating one more person, I think my life would just be complete. If I could just be a little more hateful today. If I could just show a little more malice, spend my life in that. I don't. I have walked through plenty of a cemetery putting out flags and other things, and I can't think of one single headstone where it says, just enjoyed showing malice. Wish they could have done more. It's not how it works. Not how it works at all. But spending our time and tying that back to what David had to say, I want to go back to Psalm 27 and look at verse 14. Psalm 27 and verse 14. Let's listen to the language of this kind of heart. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord. And we went in and we really discussed that verse and its applications and things. So we're not going to go back and recover that ground. But we know that David is a man who waited. And even though he knew he was the incoming king, he refused to raise his hand against God's anointed. He refused to take out King Saul by means other than allowing God to do what God was going to do when God was going to do it. And when that was accomplished, then he would take over that position of being king. But whether it be in the cave or in the camp, he was not going to raise his hand against King Saul. And even when he cut off a corner of his garment, even that he felt bad about. David is a man who is willing to wait for the Lord. And in that, he found strength. His heart was taking courage because of the waiting for the Lord. In that, though, Satan wants to whisper in our ear. He wants to come up in our conscience. And he wants to put a seed of doubt and a thought of doubt in our minds about whether waiting is actually the best thing to do or not. Is spending our time waiting actually a waste of time? And we say, well, how dare we talk about something like that? But that's a real thing that people have to consider. And doubts come up. Is all this waiting actually worth it? He had to talk extensively to the Thessalonian brethren about the coming of Jesus at a second time. And they're wondering if it was actually worth it. Let's go to Psalm 25. Psalm 25, verses 2 and 3 says, Oh my God, in you I trust. Do not let me be ashamed. And then he answers this very thing. As far as do not let my enemies exult over me, verse 3, Indeed, none of those who wait for you will be ashamed. Do you see what he just did right there? In verse 2, he expresses what sometimes gets whispered in our ear, that there is no use in waiting. King Saul had a problem with waiting. Remember, he rushed right in and he offered the sacrifice himself. He got tired of waiting. He did a lot of rushing when he should have waited for God to act. I trust in you. Do not let me be ashamed. And what he knows is, verse 3, none of those who wait for you will be ashamed. Because God will do exactly what God said he was going to do when it's the perfect time to do it. You're never going to say, well, the Bible says that God's going to do this. I don't know if he really will or not. That's never a question. If he said it, he will do it. But an outgrowth of that question is spending our lives waiting, actually a waste of time. We may ask a follow-up question. Is waiting to do things the righteous, pure, holy way a waste of time? Because sometimes we look around us and we see people who steal and lie and cheat and, you know, bend things a little bit. And it sure seems like they get ahead doing it that way. You drink with the right people, you this and that, and it seems like they get the promotion. And so is doing things the right way, the righteous way, the pure way, the holy way, is that actually a waste of time? Let's look in Psalm 37. Psalm 37 and in verse 16. And here we read, better is the little of the righteous than the abundance of many wicked. Better is the little of the righteous. So there's a conclusion here. And this is a critical question to answer. Is it worth it to wait on the Lord? And there's a whole lot that rides on your answer to that very critical question. Because if you determine that it is not worth it to wait, then you will rush headlong into other things. You'll leave aside righteousness and purity and holiness to go get it while the getting is good. And that fear of missing out that Satan is so good at playing on will kick in. And then the greed and the envy and the murder and the strife are very easy to flow after that. And so it's a question that is critical for us to come to a conclusion that I believe in. Is waiting to do things the righteous, pure, holy way a waste of time? Or is it the best way? And that answer will direct our lives. In Psalm 27 and verse 13, so a verse earlier than what we just read a moment ago, where he says, wait for the Lord. Notice this in verse 13. I would have despaired unless I had believed I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. David himself, who the next verse says to wait on the Lord, who is confident that none who wait on the Lord will be ashamed, fully admits that he had to come to that conclusion, and that if he had not come to the conclusion that it was worth it to wait on the Lord, that he would have despaired. It's hard to keep going. It's easy to give up if we do not believe that it is valuable and worth it to wait on the Lord. David is not alone in having to learn the value of waiting. Jacob, of the Bible, Jacob waited 21 years. 21 years to, what shall we say, sort of get his life started. That seems like a long time to wait. He thought he was getting a wife. He didn't get the wife that he thought he was going to get. And so that cost him another 7 years to get the wife that he thought he was going to get. 7 years and another 7 years. And then we start building up the reserves and the livestock and the property. And there's another 7 years. 21 years to get life up and going and on a firm footing, and a lot of twists and turns of wages and otherwise during that period of time. It's a long time, folks. It's a long time. Not to be outdone, though, Moses. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Do you realize that they actually passed back through the area where Moses had been living? Moses had been to Mount Sinai with his sheep before he ever set foot there to get the Ten Commandments. And from that spot, if he had simply wanted to go to Canaan, it's like 2 weeks, more like 11 days, but he could have easily been there within 2 weeks, and he could have taken several breaks along the way. And yet, by doing it God's way, it's 40 years. 40 years to go 11, 12 days worth. If Moses had not been a waiting man, a one who had been willing to wait on the Lord, he wouldn't have taken the 40-year version of that trip. Of course, then he wouldn't have gotten all the blessings that would have come along with taking the 40-year version of that trip. 40 years, that's a long time. Not to be outdone, Noah had a little project. Actually, that ark, frankly, it would have stretched from the parking lot out here most of the way down to Knightsville Road. I mean, it was huge, right? This is a big project. And he's given a number, 120 years. That's a long time. I've been put on projects before. I've never been given 120 years. It's a long time to be working on a single project, even if you do live to be 150 years old, give or take. That's still like 15% of the guy's life was wrapped up on this project. Twists and turns, support, or maybe some lack thereof in that process. Mindful of Paul, who in Philippians chapter 1, beginning in verse 21, he says that for him to live is Christ and to die is actually gain. Tell you what, that's quite a position to find yourself in life, where you're looking at life and saying, you know what, actually being dead and with Christ, that's a lot better than what I've got going on right now. But in verse 22, he says, but if I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which to choose. But I am hard-pressed from both directions, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. Yet to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake, convinced of this. I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith. It's pretty clear Paul had a lot of things squared away. And staying really wasn't for his benefit as much as it was for theirs. But he waited on the Lord. And by the way, he will get to say at the end of 2 Timothy, I fought the good fight. I have finished this course. In the future, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. And not only to me, but to all who have loved his appearing. He'll get to say that. It's just not quite time yet here when he's writing to the Philippians. Paul understood waiting on the Lord, just like Jacob, just like Moses, just like Noah. Maybe in different ways, actually. But he understood waiting on the Lord. I want to suggest to you that every believer, saint, child of God, servant that has ever lived and been found faithful in their living has experienced waiting on the Lord. It is not unique to me. It's not unique to you. It's not unique to the fellows that we've put up here on the board. But as a matter of fact, waiting on the Lord is exceptionally common amongst all who are believers. In fact, I would even go so far to say that the ability to wait well is directly tied to the concept of faithfulness. Faithfulness is not just a today thing. It's tomorrow and the next day, and for as long as it takes for me to take my last breath or for the Lord to return. And during the entirety of that time, I am called upon to wait well on the Lord. The very nature of faithfulness. In Proverbs, in Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13, we have there the 10 maidens. Five were foolish, five were prudent. Five had enough oil, which meant that even though there was a delay of the bridegroom coming, what were they able to do? Wait well. Five weren't able to wait well because they were unprepared. Right. And so their faithfulness wavered, and they were found on the outside when the great time came, waiting well. In Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, we just need to say a word about waiting and how long it may take. In Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, it says, "Do not fear what you're about to suffer." Sometimes that really makes waiting hard, by the way, when it gets rough and it gets tough and people are not supportive and all of that. Waiting can be really tough. When it calls for big changes in my life, certain things have to be put away and certain things have to be put on. That's not easy to give up and that's not easy to do. Waiting can get tough. "Do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you'll be tested and you'll have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful unto death and I will give you the crown of life." 10 days. I want you to think about the concept of 10 days. Waiting can seem like forever. And yet, from the perspective of eternity, how long is 10 days? It's a drop. It's not even a whole drop in the bucket. It's an exceptionally short period of time for us to be waiting well. And I think sometimes that whatever we're going through, trial, tribulation, difficulty, persecution, whatever it is, it might help us to step back and to view it from the perspective of eternity. And realize I'm in the 10-day waiting period. Okay? If it happens to be 10 years, it's still the 10-day waiting period. It may be the substantial portion of our lives, but it's still the 10-day waiting period. It's a relatively brief period of time, relatively short, compared to eternity, of actually having everything that your heart most desperately craves. And that's the essential, that's the essence of heaven, is it not? That in heaven, every tear is dry, no pain, no sorrow, all joys. The tree that was lost back in the garden is found there. The tree that is good for food, the leaves of the tree that are good for healing of everything that's ever hurt you. Water flowing from the throne, plentiful, to refresh you. All the best of everything. Everything that your heart craves today is found to be satisfied there. So I want to be specific. A lot of times, we just have to kind of call it as it is and just be very specific about things. So I'm going to be very specific about things. When it comes to waiting on the Lord, I want everyone to understand, between old and young, fornication is not waiting on the Lord. That is not waiting. Marriage is waiting on God's method and manner to answer whatever river of sexuality flows through us. That is God's answer. That's what is very natural to us, what He instilled in mankind, so that we be fruitful and multiply. To want to have that very natural angst, feeling, desire answered, and to have it done righteously and in purity, requires waiting on the way that the Lord said that is supposed to be answered. And that is in marriage. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4, here it says, marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Those who do not wait on the Lord and His way, His methodology, they will be judged for that. Whereas those who wait on the Lord and His method in marriage, they find that their activity meets with God's approval, and it is undefiled. And to be inclusive here, the fornication, the adultery, the homosexuality, and even things like the pornography and the things that go with it, these are not waiting on the Lord, neither His timing of things, nor in His manner of righteousness and purity and holiness to accomplish that desire. And what happens is we end up finding a shallow, hollow, empty shortcut that does not fill, that does not satisfy. It's artificial, superficial, compared to marriage. And especially when we compare it against the duration of eternity. Let's also be specific. Greed is not waiting. In Isaiah chapter 33 and verse 4, it talks about those who rush onto the spoil. Greed. Greed rather than the patience that is required to obtain things God's way. Greed mixed with jealousy and envy and covetousness. This is Satan's answer to get what you want. Exercise greed. Jealousy. Hate that person who does have what you want. See if you can take it away from them so that you have it and they don't. Don't take the time, the effort, and the energy to achieve. Hate the person who has it and see if you can take it away. Greed is not waiting. Not so long ago in the political sphere, there was an attempt to appeal to covetousness with this whole 1% thing. Oh, you know, those 1%ers. They're this and they're that. Hate the person based upon what they have. Covetousness is a very base sort of emotion to be appealing to. What about anger? Anger, I would suggest to you, is not waiting. In Colossians chapter 3 and verse 8, Colossians chapter 3, verse 8, but now you also put them all aside, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abuse of speech from your mouth. Anger, wrath, and malice, this is not waiting. Anger doesn't leave time for reason. Anger doesn't make room for accepting things that, you're right, it's wrong, it's awful, it shouldn't be that way. And in heaven it won't be. Anger is not waiting. Stealing is not waiting. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28, he who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has need. Stealing doesn't give time to using my hands to work, to acquire. Stealing is not waiting. Lying is not waiting. In the 25th verse here, he says, therefore, laying aside falsehood, speak truth, each one of you with his neighbor, for you are members of one another. Lying is not waiting. Lying is not explaining. What lying is not saying, you know what, I was wrong, and correcting it. Lying is. I would dare say that every sin, vice, error, or wrongdoing probably has some element somewhere in it of a failure to wait. To wait on the Lord, or to wait to do things the righteous, pure, holy way. Now, I'll challenge you. You can challenge me in that. And we can sit down and think about every conceivable sin to see if there's one that doesn't involve that somewhere. And I think we're probably going to find that virtually everyone has some element of a failure to wait. The Israelites couldn't wait at the border. First, they didn't want to go into the land. And then they wouldn't be told to stay out. They just wouldn't wait on the Lord. They wouldn't do things righteously. Sadly, it's one of the hallmarks of that nation. We have a different example. Jesus did wait. Jesus did. And Jesus was approved by God. Let's go to Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4. In the temptation of Jesus, it says, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he then became hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. Now, if you've got a big ego and a temper, and someone says, if, I'm telling you what, you're coming right back at him. I'll show you. That's not who he was. Verse 4, but he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Then the devil took him up into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple. And he said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you. And on their, and he, by the way, in quoting, he left out a line right there, a very important one. And the important line is that he could not tempt God by artificially and unnecessarily putting himself in harm's way. And if he did, this order of protection was not going to be afforded to him. Satan is very good about misquoting and misapplying Scripture. Just a word. He will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up. What if he didn't know that Scripture, by the way? What if he was taken off guard by that and didn't realize that Satan left out a verse there? This might have made sense. It's really important you know your Bibles. What it says, where it says it, what it means. On their hands they will bear you up so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. And Jesus said to him, on the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. That's the part Satan left out, by the way. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kings of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give to you if you fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and began to minister to him. I want to break this down for you to show you how he waited in the moment of the temptations. How he waited. The stones to bread. You know who just couldn't resist eating right away as soon as he had an opportunity to eat? You know who that guy was? Give me some of that red stuff there. That was Esau. Does it ever seem crazy to anyone else that he was willing to give away what he did for a single bowl of stew? I mean, clearly he was back to camp. I mean, could he not walk the extra 15 feet or whatever it was to get to his own tent and eat there? I mean, he was a guy that was, you know, he's always a hunter-gatherer kind, right? And he couldn't find it in his own tent? It just shows you how little he cared. But Jesus was given the opportunity to sin in a way very similar to what Esau did. Esau wouldn't wait.
And it cost him. It cost him his birthright.
Jesus didn't make Esau's mistake.
He waited.
All these kingdoms will be yours. All you've got to do is fall down and worship me. Jesus had a pretty good idea, did he not, from early on, exactly what it was going to cost him to get the kingdom that he wanted on this earth. Even when Peter is saying, "Oh, no, sir, no, you're never going to die." And what did he say? "Get behind me, Satan." No, he knew. He knew exactly what it was going to cost him.
Here was a shortcut.
You want the people? Take the people. All you got to do is fall down and worship me. That's all you got to do. Oh, it would have seemed like a nice, easy way to go if you're not willing to wait and take the 40-year trip instead of the 11-day trip. He's going to take a 3-year trip, by the way. It's going to end with a cross. That's a much harder way than what Satan was offering him here. Do you see the temptation to not wait? But what did he do? He waited.
How about this? Just throw yourself down. You know what? You want to be accepted by these people. You want the hearts and the minds of these people. You want these people to listen to you. I can't think of a better way than this. Just do it. Just throw yourself off. Angels will swoop in, set you down, and I bet all the people probably go straight to the knees and worship you right then and there. I mean, I know God's plan about this whole John the Baptist forerunner thing and the whole wilderness and locusts and wearing camel skins and all that kind of stuff. Why bother? I mean, that sounds like the hard way. I've got a much better idea. It's got flash, it's got pizzazz, and man, I bet you have a ton of followers at the end of day one. Jesus didn't take the bait. He took the hard way, the slower way. And I'm guessing as many times as they tried to lay hands on him and capture him and or imprison him or kill him, I'm guessing it had to feel like 120 years by the time he was done with these three. But he waited. And in his waiting, and by the way, I list them in that order because what you're seeing there appealed to is lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. That's what's going on in these temptations. And yet, he waited. And in his waiting, according to verse 11, that whole hunger thing and all the other stuff, notice verse 11, angels came and began to minister to him. He waited on God. Did God meet his need? And the answer is absolutely yes. God met his need. Angels ministered to him. He gained a worldwide kingdom, not just a few things surrounding Palestine over there, but he has a worldwide kingdom, an everlasting worldwide kingdom, and people to this very day are still believing him, who he was, who he is, and kneel before him. All the things that Satan was trying to get him to do right now, have it right now, but he waited. He did it God's way. And he got the glory that only God can bestow on someone. "This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him."
our story ends up at all like the story of Lazarus and the rich man and Lazarus, when Lazarus passed away, the angels came and took him away to Abraham's bosom. And I just want to suggest to you that all the things that your heart craves, all the things that you're after, all the things that you want, that in the waiting to have the Lord's things in His timing, acquired through righteousness and holiness and purity of heart and life, that our story ends just like we've seen laid out here. That there's a ministering that happens for us. There's a glory that happens for us. There's a crown of glory laid up for us as well. And what we're looking forward to is to hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." You mean we waited well? I mean you waited well. You could have taken shortcuts, and you could have stepped outside of righteousness to acquire, but you waited well. Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter in to the rest prepared for you by your master. Luke chapter 16, verses 19 through 26 is your information on the rich man and Lazarus. This morning the lesson is yours, and I hope something in there is an encouragement to you to wait on the Lord in general, but then to wait in the proper manner with righteousness and holiness and purity. And if what I want cannot be acquired and me still be righteous, if I can't get it without giving up purity, it's not worth having. It's just not worth having. Because the cost is way too high. And I am willing to wait to have all the best that God has in mind for me. And if I can't have any portion of it here, I know because He's promised it. And no one's ever been ashamed yet who waited on the Lord. I know that those things will be found in that great eternal day. This morning,